recently, you know, as we started coming out of COVID, I started working with an apprentice coach who was transitioning from being an Olympic athlete into being a coach. And they talked specifically at the moment in which they knew the gig was up. It was in the middle of lockdown. They were a senior athlete within a program. One of the junior athletes came out of the training facility in tears, essentially expressing their want, their need, their desire to compete. And that was manifesting itself in their emotions. They appeared really distressed. And at that moment, that the coach that I was working with felt nothing. And they basically ascribed this moment as being the moment when they knew it was time to step away. And that was months before Tokyo. That's a massive decision to say, I've just not got the fight anymore. Now, Luke, I believe you were talking about your motivations to leave the sport at the top of the game. But when was that recognition event for you and for Bradley and for Leslie to say it's time to step away?
Welcome to the Coaching Discourse podcast. I've been known in the past to offer a bit of a long-winded intro, which I'll try and refrain doing tonight. But certainly, if given the opportunity, I would speak about our three guests for a long time. So to position this episode, I think it stems from my desire to more explicitly lean into and connect with the experience of athletes and in the discussions that we have on the podcast. And each of our three guests have been, or to some degree still are, full-time athletes. So before I ask them to introduce themselves, I'm just going to say a couple of sentences on each and then I'll hand over to them. So I'll begin with Luke. Luke and I have known one another since we were kids, when we learned to sail together on the west coast of Scotland, him doing it a hell of a lot better than I ever did. And I've followed his career with real interest. And although like we have relatively few interactions now, certainly the ones that we do have, I'm always left with a really thoughtful smile. I'm super stoked that you've come on, Luke. Leslie, I don't even know where to begin with you. You play a number of roles in my life and we continue to connect through a number of different things. And I think the most common thread between them would be, I think you're someone that brings real incredible strength of character, and you think very critically about the life you live and the way you engage with people. And Brad, we've not known each other for that long. I think we were introduced probably just over a year ago. And I was invited to come on to a call, which we continue to do once a month. You bring a phenomenal amount of experience and always speak with real humility. And I guess from a selfish point of view, I'm interested in the various roles that you have and continue to play in sport and those transition points and perhaps how it shapes what you do now. So thanks to each of you for joining us. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourselves and then I'll kick off with the first question. So I'll hand over to Luke to start and you can pass to whoever you want. And I think everyone's brought a drink as well. And I know that you're a big whiskey fan, Luke. So maybe in your intro, you could tell us what you've got in your hand tonight.
Okay. Well, good evening, everyone. As Laurie mentioned, I'm Luke Patience, and I'm a very small West Coast Scottish lad. I'm 35 years old and I'm three Olympics down, and I'm just off the back of having decided to stop my Olympic career after Tokyo 2020. And so I'm fresh out of it, fresh with all sorts of thoughts, not sure quite where I sit with it yet. But however, I'm here tonight with some good people, having a wee dram of the water of life, as is normal for us Scots. And looking forward to a good chat. So yeah, I'm interested to see how it goes. Thanks for having me. Oh, sorry, and I'm meant to be handing on. Leslie, ladies first, all in this case, in the middle.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks for the lovely intro, Laurie. I don't quite know how I'm going to follow that. I always get a bit stumped on how to introduce myself. I'm wondering what's going to come out of my mouth right now. So who am I tonight? Which priority will I use to introduce myself? I'm an ex-professional snowboarder. Could say I'm an ex-professional skier and then snowboarder. Although I still snowboard, I still guide in the backcountry if I'm working in that space. I competed in halfpipe snowboarding at three Olympics. I also competed in snowboard cross and alpine snowboarding at World Cup level, which is quite unusual to have competed in all the different disciplines. I did compete in slopestyle, but before it went into the Olympics. So slopestyle wasn't accepted as an Olympic discipline until 2012. So multi-discipline snow sport athlete, and then I moved into coaching and then team management work, film production, coaching, course delivery, bit of a Swiss Army knife of snow sports really. And now I'm a colleague of yourself and Derek as a coach developer, and Anna actually as well. Working in lots of different sports, so not just snow sports. And I'll pass to Brad.
G'day, good morning. So I'm on coffee. It's actually a very, very strong coffee. I'm hoping will kick in soon. 6 a.m. here, just south of Sydney, waiting for the sun to get up. My life has been in cycling up until probably about 18 months ago, where I had a shift into coach development, so working with a lot of sports, which has been amazing. But the cycling journey kicked off way back pre-Atlanta, sort of fast-tracked into the Atlanta Olympics and did four cycles as a track athlete. Spent some time as a pro road rider as well on the international circuit. And then I'm sort of flipped off the bike and, as we say, into the car, in following those mad Tour de France bike riders, yelling into a radio and suffering all kinds of stresses. Team management in the professional cycling is just nuts. So I spent about 5 years doing that before I came back to Australia and took up a coaching role with the State Institute here in New South Wales. And then that led to national team roles. So I did, Rio and Tokyo cycles as the sort of national road cycling coach. And then, like I said, I flipped in out of the cycling silo and into coach development, which has just been a fascinating, mind-blowing, perspective-opening experience. It's been really cool. And that's how I've come to get to know Laurie on some webinars, sort of communities, practice, dare I say, social learning groups, and not only has my perspective opened up into other sports, but it's opened up a whole network of new and amazing people. So it's been a really cool journey these last 18 months, if not the whole journey, but yeah, really, really cool stuff in the last couple of years.
Awesome, thank you. Anna, Derek, we're going to do drink intros because usually we do a 2-beer minimum, don't we? But we're finding our diaries are becoming somewhat constraining. So what are you drinking, Derek and Anna?
My feelings mostly. I had COVID last week, so I'm feeling a bit sorry for myself. I'm drinking Hazy Jane by BrewDog.
I like that.
Just a good steady Eddie to kick in a Wednesday evening after putting the kids to bed. Another reason why I might be drinking my feelings bedtime as a single parent.
I've just got a little red wine. I don't really know what type it is. I just sort of chucked it in a glass and ran up the stairs to join this call. So, but looking forward to this. Your friends are so cool, Laurie.
Yeah, it's great to have them on, isn't it, Anna? I'm drinking a Negroni because I know that Derek loves it. And it's made by Downpour, which is a wee company based in North Uist that make a fabulous gin. They also make Negroni now. And look, they're making a whiskey as well, single malt. I don't know when it's coming out, but...
Yeah, I know, they are, yeah. Probably should have mentioned that I'm trying to push myself into the whiskey sector as well. But yeah, I have heard that. So that comes in a wee bag ready to go.
The Negroni?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it comes in a bottle ready to roll. So I've never actually made one from scratch. Yeah. Lazy, but it's good.
Can I ask, a wee dram, is that specifically a scotch, or is it anything that gives you a little bit of a tickle?
No, it's specific to whiskey, yeah. So a dram is a measure. It's not really associated with the size of the measure. It's just a dram is what we would say if we're going to have a whiskey. Say you would have a dram.
Right.
And so the wee dram, which is usually about that tall.
Yeah. Is that like the Little John effect? You know, it's actually big, but you say it's wee. I've got to take some notes here.
Having a dram is like
and get it wrong, you know.
Having a dram is like sitting around a table drinking a bottle of whiskey for 4 hours with your mates. That's having a dram.
Yeah, yours is quite big tonight, Luke. What whiskey are you drinking?
So this is an Old Pulteney. This is Scotland's northernmost mainland distillery. There's distilleries in the Orkneys and on the islands further north, but this is near Wick, about as far as you can go. A 12-year-old, and it's drinkable. It's dangerous though, because it's like apple juice to me. This could just go down, go down, and go down. A really nice, like honey, sweet, easy to drink. Recommended if you're not that into whiskey. It would be a good starter.
I was just about to say, I'm a Scottish person that's not really that much of a fan of whiskey, so maybe I'll need to try that one.
Yeah, I would. We could change that, and this would be a good place to start. Yeah.
Challenge accepted by Anna. Okay, right, question one. I'm actually referring to the notes that we sent round. I maybe will apologise in advance because I've connected the three of you through the triple games that you've each done, and I don't know how you feel about that because I know it will be just one of many connections that you all have, but I've used that one. So here we go. Leslie, Luke, Brad, each of you have spent a significant amount of time competing as full-time athletes, which includes, as I've just said, three Olympic Games. How have these experiences shaped you, your outlook on sport and sport coaching? And I'll put it to the floor. Who wants to kick us off?
I'll go. I can see Bradley and Luke trying to hide. When I read your question, I was like, wondering what lies behind the question. First of all, I was super curious that you picked the three Olympics as a way to connect us. It's not an unexpected way to connect three people who have all been to three Olympics. It's the kind of question that you would get from a journalist, definitely. I noticed that I started to fall into the kind of answer that I would give a journalist. And I know that's not the kind of answer that you want. So there was something interesting there that I immediately fell into a kind of rote answer around Olympic pathways, Olympic facing sport, especially as a free sports or action sports athlete or ex-athlete. And how I felt I needed to defend my position as a elite performer in an Olympic focused sport as a snowboarder. And I spent a lot of time and energy doing that. I stopped competing in 2010 and was competing on the World Cup tour already in 1997. So it's like a different world, a long, long time ago. So if you go back to the late 90s and early 2000s, one of the questions I got asked by pretty much every single mainstream sports journalist who interviewed me was, you don't have dreadlocks. Oh, do you smoke weed? Do you, whatever trope they thought was going to be relevant to snowboarders or action sports people. It was really close to the music industry in the late 90s and early 2000s, and the kind of stereotyping was definitely there. So I developed a bit of a defence mechanism as an elite athlete, albeit I come from alpine skiing, which is back in the late 90s and early 2000s was a complete polar opposite in terms of the kind of lifestyle that you would be associated with if you were a professional alpine skier. It's a lot more similar to other mainstream elite sports in that already there was a high level of sports science involved, coaching involved, and to go back to the mid 90s, that really at the very inception of big funding into sport in the UK. So, you know, my career predates the high performance sports system as we know it now. So that's shaped my view quite heavily, but Olympics was never the main thing for me as a snowboarder. Olympics was always something separate because I left alpine skiing to get away from Olympic pathways. I left alpine skiing to get away from sports politics and funding systems and everything that comes with that, because snowboarding was creative, innovative, challenging, fun in a social kind of way, very community focused, extremely progressive, very, very, very challenging. And a lot of hard work. I loved the challenge and the hard work part of all the sports I was involved in. I was involved in a lot of sports growing up. So when snowboarding became an Olympic sport, and I've spent my whole adult life balancing that high performance sports system versus action sports, lifestyle, community focused approach, and cultural approach, if you like. I think it's good to point out that Olympics was always second. Snowboarding community, progression, learning, adventure, independent events, how everything connected together. That was always first for me as a snowboarder because it was my second career. That's not to say that I didn't put in a maximum effort, dedication, focus, drive to everything I was doing in the Olympic space. I always tried to balance it with other priorities. And my experiences of going to the Olympics taught me that I'm really glad I did that. I had three very different experiences. I never did conventionally well at an Olympics. I didn't have my best ever results at Olympics. Certainly didn't get anywhere near the podium. I've won World Cups. I crashed in every single Olympics I went to. I got completely panned by the media. I got trolled. It wasn't a pleasant experience, certainly the middle Olympics I went to. But because it wasn't, I hadn't fully identified with it as being the be-all and end-all of my elite sport career, I was able to cope. I was able to put that to the side and go and do some other filming or other competitions and survive that kind of bruising attack. Hopefully that wouldn't happen these days. Hopefully. I'm not sure. I didn't really have anybody in my Olympic space getting my back. I was pretty alone when it all went wrong. But I learned a lot, and I guess coming out the other end, I take a lot of those experiences into the work I do when I'm trying to find what else makes people tick when people are coaching or competing. I'm always hopeful that it's not just Olympic focused things that make them tick. Did that answer your question? Sorry, ramble.
There's so many questions and things I would like to understand from what Leslie shared, but I'm going to hand over to Luke or Brad.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to, I always find it very fascinating to listen to different sports. We're all individuals, so we have a very different experience, but then you add that to having a different cultural approach in different sports, it just accentuates that even further. So I always find it really, I always want to ask more things than I talk about when we do these things, three Olympics for me has been a very interesting journey, of which most certainly started how I had imagined it would and dreamed it would, but most certainly finished in a very different way. And I think that the So London 2012 was my first Olympics, and very fortunately, I, you know, thank my mum and dad for that night that they decided to have me as a kid, you know, just the perfect age for a home Olympics. You know, there a lot of this is luck with those things. But London was a very unique experience for a Brit, obviously, and any home games for anyone is obviously a very unique experience. With my teammate at the time, Stuart Bithell, we fired out the blocks and won a silver medal at that games. And I kind of felt like, well, here we are, you know, we're on the path and we're on the rocket and off we go. And it's funny, sort of two more Olympics later, I think one of the bigger, you know, I could talk about, as we all can, could talk about all the things we went through for hours and hours and hours, but that's not the point. But I think one of the biggest things that surprised me and that I had to learn on my feet as I went is the fundamental drivers had to change from being a 22-year-old, you know, getting their first ticket to the first Olympics versus being a 34-year-old where I expected to go to another Olympics. You know, it started out as a dream and a desperation to make it happen. And it ended in a way like, make sure you do your career proud, you know, everything you represent, two decades of hard work. And so for me, what got me out of bed in the morning was vastly different from 18 years old to 34 years old, like vastly different, despite the goal being identical to be Olympic champion. And I find that an interesting journey. And of course, it didn't happen overnight. Of course, in the end, I hung up the boots at 18 years in full-time sailing. So it obviously was a slow creep over those 18 years. But I think that's one of the things that it taught me the most is that it was not sustainable to be the inspired 18-year-old for the span of my career. It just wasn't realistic. And the expectation changes from, you know, for me, London was a line in the sand of prior to London, am I good enough? You're wondering. Post-London was like, right, I've proved I am. Now how do we replicate it? And for me, that was a clear line in the sand in my career and one that I felt I didn't know was coming. And it was quite a challenge to try and work around that. And it wasn't a slow process for me either. It took a wee while to work that out, and I had a wobble in the middle of my career and re-gripped it again and found what the new drivers were and all that sort of stuff, but it wasn't simple at all. It was interesting to think about, you know, you mentioned about coaches there as well, Laurie, and you know, almost in correlation with the experience that I gathered through those 18 years is the type of coaching I needed changed. So in the earlier years, it was much more about, you know, you're young, you're a firework, you're filled with enthusiasm and passion, and you don't necessarily direct it in good places. And I needed a coach, someone, an elder, someone experienced that could help keep my feet in the ground and help drive that wildness into a good place. And as I got older, I learned to do that myself, and I didn't need babysat. What I needed was somebody that would help facilitate an environment to leave me to it, which is almost a complete opposite, you know, from how it all started out. Is that you get to a stage, we all get to a stage when we are the masters of our craft. There's no one can teach you how to do something better. That's not how it works anymore. What they're there to do is to help hold up the mirror so that you can look into it, I think, anyway, and question, you know, do I still back myself? Do I still believe in my process? And they're there to help facilitate. For me, they were there to help facilitate that process. And so, because there's nothing they could tell me of how to sail the boat quicker, because you're the expert at that point. And so the coaching, the correct coach and that journey I went on also in correlation was really interesting, and that changed too. But funnily enough, there's not like it seems so simple now as I think back, but there's no one there to tell you that's going to happen, you know, or no one there to help facilitate like hey son, one day you're going to be the best at what you do, so it's all going to have to change. So I find it really interesting now to think back on all those days and in the change that's happened. Full stop.
Yeah, wow. What a couple of cool journeys we've had there. My goodness. Leslie, I was just having this conversation yesterday at the Institute of Sport here, and I was in a room full of, you know, high performance people, and the subject was has anyone been in one of those half pipes for the snowboard? And you know, just talking about how like crazy that is and how on the edge you are and throwing yourself in there. I've been to the top of one, but I've never ventured into one in my short time on snow, but I'd love, we could sit on that all day, I reckon. Just what does it take to launch into one of those things and try to do a bloody trick?
Even now, if I'm in a ski resort where there is an Olympic half pipe, I wonder how does that work? And then if I don't think about it and just go, it works. So, yeah,
wow. And I'm just sitting here listening. It's just crazy. Luke, I've got this live guide. I don't know if you've heard about it. There's a sailing event from Sydney to Hobart every Boxing Day. And I've got a mate around the corner here who's a mad sailing person. Comes from over your way, actually, one of those islands between France and England. And so he introduced me to a little bit of sailing here at the Fitzroy Falls Reservoir Sailing Club. It's like about 1 kilometer in wide stretch of water, and there's a sailing club there. I went out, my abs are still sore from hanging off the edge of this.
Good man. So, good man. Yeah, did you get seasick?
Sorry. No, it's not that big. Just the sore abs. Yeah. Trying to get some weight on this thing.
Yeah, good man.
Some of the most ferocious competition I've ever been in is sailing. We did some team building up around the islands of Denmark many years ago, one of the pro teams I was with. And so we come out of the wilderness 3 days of, not eating and not sleeping, and suddenly we're taught how to sail one of these little, I'm going to say it's like a laser thing. I'm sorry, I'm getting it wrong. Normally it's only two person, but we're like five on there, it's team building. And we're taught how to sail these things, to get the start right, and then go out around the buoy and then catch the wind and steal wind and all that. And it was just pure competition. You can look the other captain in the eye when you just go around the buoy in front of them. And I've never felt that before in any of the cycling I've ever done. I don't know. I've been so attracted to get back into that space.
Good on you. Know. Yeah, you should. You should.
Yeah, so it's coming. It's coming. But if I could share a little bit of my sort of Olympic sort of journey. And I was just sitting here listening, and it's reminded me of a conversation I had yesterday with a coach I'm working with who's about to head over World Championships, Com Games. And it's one of those conversations you have. What are your key challenges? What are you looking forward to? And end up centering around a key point, a couple of athletes he's working with. And this was not even really specific to the events they were going into. It was just in general about how the coach felt like at least one of the athletes wasn't really respecting him as a person, his time, his efforts, his time away from family, his attention on their journey. And we found ourselves really spending a lot of time on it. And I was able to share some of my experiences there as well, working with athletes who have, can be quite consuming of people. And it's a bit of a touch point for me, because if I think back when I was a young Olympian, I had the goggles on, I had the tunnel vision, and I fret that I was one of those consuming athletes that just knew nothing else, and so it's a bit of a sensitive touch point for me. And what it is sort of I've got to realize is, well, what is it all about? It's similar to what Leslie started with answering the question, what's the deeper meaning here? And that's been, you know, I'm a little bit older than you there, Luke and Leslie, and I've had the bit of, you know, a long time to sort of exit from what was largely an identity based all around the Olympic Games as an Olympic athlete. And now I'm a little bit removed from that, sure, supporting people, coaches, and then therefore athletes to Olympics. But definitely don't feel like my whole life identity is about being an Olympian. And the big question is, well, what was it all about? You know, what did I really get out of, you know, those Olympic cycles? And it was largely the relationships that you hold on to now. And when you meet up with people that were involved in those times, you're not talking about podiums or, you know, how shiny the medals were or anything like that. That's the last thing you talk about. It's just the connections you had and the experiences you had together. And so I'm sort of challenged with that now. It's like, well, it's still competition, you know. I think I just shared with you, Luke, there, I love competition, you know, and sailing. Give me a Scrabble game and I'm all in, and I'll get a kick out of that and go hard. But where's the balance between what are we really getting out of it as far as those life experiences? What does it all mean? And where does, is it still okay to go in really heavy for the win? I'm okay with it. I'm starting to get it. I struggle to articulate it, but I've got this guiding light that I'm really comfortable with it. So we go hard, but we remind ourselves that, you know, what is it all about? What are we really going to get out of this journey? If I reflect back to some of the coaching that enabled me, I was reminded, Luke, thank you, from some of the environments I was in and how lucky I was also. My first two cycles was under a very, very tough regime. It was silent coaching. It was, here's your 11-month a year program handed on day one, and you're just expected to rock up and be there day in, day out, and very, very, very little, absolutely minimal conversation or dialogue with the coach. And that was sink or swim. And it was horrible. It would start with 20-odd athletes, and yeah, by the end of the season, you'd be down to the minimum five we needed. There was no selection needed because it was just whoever was left. And that was it. And it was relatively successful. And I gained a lot out of it because I was able to survive. But you think back to the athletes that didn't and some of the turmoil that created of the most horrible outcomes in some regards. And then I went into a different coach for my last two cycles where, again, it was silent, but for different reasons, the coach just struggled to communicate but had a genuine care for each individual. So it went from, here's your program, sink or swim, just rock up, to another coach where it was literally asking the question, what do you need? And it came at a good time in my career, similar to you, Luke, where I was able to answer that. So you take that into the professional ranks, where coaching was a completely different kettle of fish. It was literally, we pay you to do your job, so rock up and be ready. At the start of my professional career, towards the end, it was recognizing, you know, well, you know, again, professional, business-minded, we've got a return on investment need here, so we're going to bring in some high-level coaching. But very different to the Olympic regimes where, you know, it was largely, you know, honour of the flag and the jersey. But in the pros, it was, oh, God, we got some money to spend here and some sponsors to support. So I felt sort of the two or a couple of different edges there, the coaching. And so what does that do to influence me in my coaching? I'd like to think it enabled me to be a lot more athlete-centered. You know, we talk about that, but what does that really mean? I was always genuinely in for the care of the athlete. And probably at times was a bit soft on that because at times, you know, to really enable an athlete to recognise and realise their full potential, you've got to go through some struggle. And I think as a young coach, I struggled to go through the struggle at any length of time. Whereas later on, you could bunker down and survive through those tough periods, knowing that, you know, this is necessary to reach that full potential. And so now, as a coach developer, I'm, you know, what can I do to influence coaches to enable that that ability to go through that struggle with their athletes, and just to endure and hang on that little bit longer. That's sort of where I'm at now. I'm by no means feel like I'm anywhere in near mastery of any of that. I think reflection helps. I've come out of my shell a lot where I can have these conversations, engage with people where for probably the better half of all that was very insular and very self-reflective, but not able to articulate in any way. So I find that really helps. But where I guess I just close, like I still feel like, you know, I still feel very, very attached to the Olympic Games. Probably becoming more of a fan now. I feel like removed. I've got an influence on it through, you know, a couple of different layers, quite removed. It's been a wild and turbulent in some ways journey from that, you know, tunnel vision 18-year-old that was like earmarked for the Sydney Olympics when it was announced, to where I'm at now. It's and you know, being able to have these conversations with and listening to other amazing journeys. So thank you for the opportunity. It's great to connect here. Look out, I am actually looking at getting out and about. This term study tour, Laurie, I've never heard it before. Maybe Derek, you have in the academic world. But I was just talking to my manager yesterday and we're looking at some you know, how can Brad get better at what he does and get out and about and see some amazing people do their thing in real time. So yeah, look out for that. I might be putting my hand up for some experiences.
Open arms, Brad. Open arms and with whiskey in hand. We'll show you what a wee dram is. Yeah. I know so many people will have questions, like I'm left with lots, and thank you for your considered responses, the three of you. Just before I ask Derek and Anna or any of you to jump in, I have to ask Brad, right at the beginning of our conversation, you said over the last 18 months it's been mind-blowing and perspective shifting. You have such breadth and depth in the experiences that you've had in performance sports. So what is it about the last 18 months then that has been mind-blowing and perspective shifting?
So on a couple of levels, like just working with different sports, we're 16 sports at the New South Wales Institute of Sport. And I spent, you know, largely, I did multiple sports as a kid, you know, from water skiing to soccer and cross country and everything, you know, tennis, all the, you know, you imagine Australia, young kid, you grow up, you do everything. And then I went into cycling. By the time I was 16, 17, I was full-time, straight out of high school, into the Australian Institute of Sport. And I retired when I was 32, did 400,000 kilometres on a bike in that time probably. So it wasn't a lot of time for anything else. And then suddenly, you know, 18 months ago or so, I stepped out of that, took the blinkers off and started working with other coaches and other cycling, other sport programs, and just recognising, yeah, there's a lot of similarity. You know, at the end of the day, it's sport, it's seeking, it's goal setting and you know, aspiring to achieve and setting up plans and problem solving. There's a lot of similarities, but just the take that coaches have on how to approach those things, the different takes, the different challenges in sports. It's been you know, self-reflective, you think back, you know, when I was a coach, oh my God, you know, it sort of opens up a whole can of worms, like, oh my goodness, you know, like, similar when I went from athlete to coach, then you reflect back as you were as an athlete. I think I started with this, you know, oh my God, how troublesome must I have been for my coaches. When you go into a different sports with different coaches, their different take on things, you reflect back on, oh my God, how much did I miss as a coach? Then at the same time, it's equally confirming with a lot of things. So you struggle with that, you know, like, oh, that, yeah, I was shit at that, but I went all right with that. But you move through that, and now you sort of, okay, well, together, so myself with coaches, together we can move towards the future. And that's the exciting bit. So a big part of what I do is I connect coaches. And then together as coaching groups and or buddies or groups or communities, that's where the really exciting bit is, because that I feel is quite new here in Australia, if not around the world. I know, Laurie, I often lean on our monthly call-ins, and we look to you and the team over there as world experts, because you've been in it forever. But you're sure it hasn't been forever. And so that's the exciting bit is, you know, the more our communities connect and we cross-pollinate across sports, then that's the exciting bit. It's been perspective opening, but I guess probably it's more about energizing to what could be next as we all connect. Yeah. I hope that answers your question, Mike.
Yeah. Silence.
Sorry.
Not anymore when you say silence.
Yeah, no. It's funny. One of the things I was thinking about when you're saying that, Brad, was I often find that sailing's a weird sport in some respects where there is so much autonomy. You know, when you talked about the difference between the Olympic stuff and versus moving into, say, that pro world, I'm not sure that's the right terminology, but, you know, and where contracts are bigger, there's more money floating around and things like that. And then you're suggesting you maybe slipped back into a place where you'd been before, where you're kind of given a program, you have to turn up and that's what you do. I don't know that world as much. Sailing doesn't have the exposure in the media that gives it sponsorship that reflects. I mean, sailing's a horrifically expensive sport, and sadly, with there's not many people that really engage in it in the media because it's hard to watch. But so much autonomy in Olympic sailing. So I would pick my coach. So I'm the employer, essentially. Not it's not perfectly like that financially. We would get two bodies of funding, one from the government, if you will, and the federation and what have you, and I would subsidize that. Well, if I wanted the right coach, I would have to subsidize them heavily, because the government funding isn't enough for the handful of good it's not a handful, but the coaches that are in our sport around the world that are really, really good are few and far between, and they cost money. And so I would heavily subsidize our coach, but I am the employer. Wow. And so I am essentially setting what I need from my coach to achieve my goals. It's all me, and my teammate, you know? And it's interesting because I am learning about this world more and more, where it's, how I really like this. How do you coach coaches? Like it's a new thing. Whereas I've come from a world where it's like, this is what I require to achieve my goal, and I need you to do this for me. And it's totally different, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's totally different, and it's odd as well. And so, but equally, I would expect my coach to be as passionate about winning as me. So it's not about the paycheck. And I would expect them to go to the extra mile because they expect me to go the extra mile. And because there's not that much money, in all honesty, in sailing, you're kind of all in it from pulling each other's heartstrings for the end goal. Because you're all going to walk away at the end of it in debt, you know, or just about come out even if you're lucky, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the whole thing is driven off passion. It's not a job. And as well, for snowboarding there, Leslie, I imagine that's another difference yet again. Like, it's really interesting when I was listening to what you first said, like the Olympics is a second thing here, and Brad, you talking about the professional world, and me talking about the slightly weird sailing world where essentially the sailor is the manager of the program, the athlete is the manager. We've got three very different we couldn't be more different in how our worlds have been building up to this. It's interesting.
I can see Laurie there, just like, whoa! I've brought these people together, you know. Like, but Leslie, I'll be curious. What was coaching like for you? I didn't hear coaching mentioned throughout your journey. I'm really curious. What was it for you through that?
So I think it changed a lot over over the period that I was snowboarding. I was so lucky to be involved in snowboarding at that time. It was a really key time in the development of snowboarding. Snowboarding was a test event in Nagano Olympics in 1998. And I didn't compete in Nagano. I was actually racing on alpine snowboards in 97. And I started to ride halfpipe in end of 97. I just missed qualifying. I'd switched in 96 from alpine skiing to alpine snowboarding. So I just missed qualifying for the Nagano Olympics. Obviously, extremely long shot to think you're going to qualify for an Olympics in less than a year. So yeah, wasn't why I kind of had taken up snowboarding for a number of other reasons. That's a whole different story. But my initial experience of coaching, this is relevant, was in alpine snowboarding, and it was with a French pro team. And at the time, I don't know if you know much about the history of snowboarding, there were two different World Cup tours. There was the International Snowboard Federation Professional Tour, not Olympic focused, because the IOC gave the International Ski Federation the rights to run Olympics. It was very political at the time, caused no end of trouble, and kind of reverberates to this day. I won't go into that, but the French pro team that I trained with ran their program along similar lines to sports that, you know, cycling, that have a pro team. They were sponsored by brands. There was money involved. There was money up for grabs. On a much smaller scale, obviously, snowboarding in the mid to late 90s didn't have a huge amount of money, but it had more money than it has now. It was attracting big lifestyle sponsors and sponsors that were also sponsoring MTV Snowball, big events, big live music events as well. So the coaches who were coaching on the ISF pro team were actually really on their game. They had the most up-to-date knowledge of that was available in the late 90s. We did a lot of very structured strength and conditioning, very similar to the alpine ski coaching that I'd just come from. It was the attitude that was really different. So it wasn't, it didn't feel, how do I say this? It didn't feel like a controlled environment. It felt like a very supportive environment. It felt like an adventure. It felt like you were taking things on rather than this. You described that 20 athlete pool who it was really brutal. And the, you know, if you survived, if you got through, if you're one of the five that got through the process at the end, then you were the kind of lucky one that went on to go and compete. Whereas we all worked really, really hard. It was still quite brutal, but it didn't feel like that in any way. You know, we were all in it together, and if anything, that helped us push harder. But when I moved into halfpipe snowboarding, it was far less organized. That although there were pro teams, and again, this is going back sometime the late 90s, and by that stage, Salt Lake City was the next Olympics. Snowboarding in America was massive. It was becoming more and more popular. There was even more money involved. So coaching became started to become slightly different than halfpipe riding because of the influence of the Olympics and national associations. And the first wave of halfpipe snowboard coaches, who had just come directly from riding themselves, had no experience of coaching, were coaching in a real peer-to-peer way. And snowboarding, halfpipe snowboarding, is very much like skateboarding. You very much learn with your friends, and it's all about your crew. So we use that term a lot, riding buddies, or my crew, my homies. Language like that is used a lot. And what that really means is that to take risks and to push outside of what you can do, what is possible, and to feel supported enough to make calculated decisions. And I don't want to make it sound as though snowboarders or skateboarders are reckless when they do these new or progressive or crazy tricks. It's usually extremely calculated, but it's also supported. It's usually a group decision, and it's a part of a process that's ongoing the whole time, and you're always waiting for that right moment, and the coach really facilitates that moment. We've used that language already. So Luke, I think when you said, you know, by the end of your career, you were looking for a coach who could facilitate the environment and hold the mirror up. And that naturally happens in these free sports environments between the athletes and the peers. So the coaches back in the, you know, early 2000s were just a kind of more official facilitator, if you like. And I think that's really special. We've managed within snowboarding at elite level to hold on to enough of that approach. And interestingly, as time's gone on, and what we're in 2022, so 22 years later, a lot of the theoretical research in coaching is backing up that kind of approach, whereby it's really environment focused, it's very social, it's very relational, taking risks is a communal responsibility, although the ultimate progression is performed by, I'm using performed purposely there, the individual is owned by the group. So my experience of coaching is around that kind of feel, if you like. It's very much a feel. By the time I switched from competing to coaching myself full time, I'd already been coaching an awful lot. I coached throughout my whole career as an athlete. There was never a time I wasn't coaching. I just changed my focus, if you like. It's important to note that definitely as an athlete, you're a snowboarder is still very self-centered. They're very competitive. It's still, although it's not about the win, it is about the best performance. So I don't want to sound as though the competition isn't important. And I think I became more aware that role is, or how roles are perceived is important and has a massive effect. So although from the outside looking in, my coaching behavior probably wasn't that different when I was officially, and I was coaching for Quicksilver Roxy, so as a brand team manager coach rather than in a national team at first. If you'd looked at my last few years as an athlete to my first 2 years as a coach, as an outsider, it might not look that different. There were subtle differences because I all of a sudden learned that my peers perceived me and my role, especially the power dynamics, slightly differently. And that was a learning experience because I didn't see that coming. By that, you know, what do I mean by that? Things that I would have said as an athlete that would have been acceptable and taken as supportive, said in the role of a coach, if the receiver had perceived me in the more authoritative role, had a detrimental or controlling effect. So that was a major change. Since, you know, in the last 10 years, what's changed in coaching and free sports? I think it went free, or snowboard, freestyle snowboards in particular, went through a stage where coaches tried to adopt an approach to coaching that was more similar to how other sports were being coached, and then quickly realized that they were about to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. So that there was a lot of really, really strong things, or good approaches, good perspectives, good ways of working in freestyle snowboarding that really had to be better understood, be kind of protected, if you like. New Zealand's done a really good job of combining research in coaching and freestyle snowboarding with applied research and identifying in a more academic way what's important and why it's important. So there is work being done. There's very little research in freestyle snowboard coaching, but it's starting to happen. And certainly we have some great conversations now that we've got our brothers and sisters, cousins in surfing, sport climbing, freestyle, BMXing, skateboarding, breakdance, all these free sports or action sports who are being recognised as Olympic sports now, I think the conversation will become wider. Good question, though.
I'm looking for a pen here, Laurie. I want to take notes down, but we're recording a podcast, aren't we? I can listen back to this.
Yeah, exactly.
Scribbling under the screen. My mind
No, no, it's needed. Where are you sat with Derek? Go for it.
Oh, no, sorry. I was just going to say to Leslie's point, what I find interesting is that, okay, so take cycling and sailing. They're old sports, really, you know, and they've been around for a very long time. It's interesting to, I mean, snowboarding essentially a relatively new, but it's a brand new sport, really. I mean, as I keep getting told, I'm a nipper and I was alive when it was invented. So, you know, but what I find, what's really curious is to hear, I can only imagine the sport is going through quite a constant and steep rate of evolution all the time. And I imagine even in 10 years from now, it might perhaps look very different maybe there's a way to measure rate of turns on massive jumps or something, or, you know, what is the perfect angle for your rail to take off on a kicker to produce the maximum amount of gyration in your radius or blah, 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 whatever it all is, you know? And I wouldn't know at all. But one of the things that always does strike me as curious is when, you know, you talked about that sense of your crew and it's a group of you that are exploring a new trick or a new method to go about something. And I'm just giving an observation that I find that such an alien concept to me, because the very last thing I would do would be share anything with anybody, you know. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying right or wrong. It's clear, just purely an observation about the different worlds and cultures we come from. And I can imagine there are pros and cons for each, you know. We've tried and failed to create this environment where we have a squad that is pulling each other on against the foreigners, you know, wherever you're from, everyone else is a foreigner, aren't they? And it doesn't work because only one boat gets to go to the Olympics. And even if it wasn't any one boat, my personality, and I would assume that above all else, make sure you're the best. So I would only wish my mates to fail and me to succeed. And it doesn't come from a malicious place. It comes from the deep desire to be the best and the fear of failure, you know, especially failure in front. It's fine to fail in front of sponsors. It's fine to fail in front of teams in front of your mates. I find the hardest failure to take, you know, even though they're the most supportive often. Sometimes some of my mates are pricks, but you know, and so, yeah, it's such a interesting, and one of the things that sprung to mind there when you were talking about it was Sean White clearly was one of the trailblazers in halfpipe, unless, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, being an outsider to snowboarding, he was clearly a trailblazer. And do you think his crew was, as you were, do you think his crew was a collection of athletes that he would be competing against? Or do you think his crew was actually something that's more behind the scenes and insular, and that was what was one of the ingredients that made him such a trailblazer and arrive at the next Olympics with a trick that no one had ever seen, or the X Games or what have you? Quite a long-winded question, that, sorry.
Great question. It's a really interesting story. And I mean, I'm a huge Sean White fan. I think he's just such a phenomenal athlete, and to see him compete in this year in Beijing in the halfpipe and take it on and ride at the level he rode at was just, you know, had tingles going up and down my spine. I think there's, you know, it's so risky to do the runs that you know, somebody like Sean White was doing in the halfpipe, or that the slope style athletes were doing in Beijing. for those athletes to be able to pull off what they're doing, they're taking very real risks. And the consequences, you know, the exposure to consequences is huge. If it goes wrong, you know, worst case scenario is worst case scenario. It's life-changing injuries that happen. So really that lends itself to the idea of communal value in a trick. Of course, these riders are so competitive. They desperately want to be that athlete who lands that first new trick. Like, progression is a currency in competitive freestyle snowboarding, and it's very, very valued. And I think that it's not that they don't want to win, but they need each other to be able to take that risk, to be able to weigh up the pros and cons, to balance the consequences and make that decision of, is this worth it to me to try this? Because the consequences are so grave if it goes wrong, potentially. And I might sound melodramatic, but at some stages, so going back to Sean White, that's exactly what it was like. So in the run-up to the Vancouver Olympics, then I'm sure this is well documented, you know, Kevin Pierce was another US snowboarder, and him and Sean were very much head-to-head competing against one another, and who was going to be the first to land the double cork and back-to-back double corks. And they both had very good sponsorship, and Sean took himself away and trained on his own, which at the time was very frowned upon. Kevin invited the rest of the crew, because before they'd been all training as a crew, 6, 7, 8, 9 riders together. And Sean really, it was felt at the time that Sean's behaviour was not in keeping with snowboard culture. I'll leave you to go and investigate the story, because it's an interesting one for yourself. That what ended up happening is Kevin tried to go and learn this double cork in the pipe that Sean had managed to learn in a reduced risk environment, which was a foam pit built into a half pipe at quite a big expense from one of Sean's sponsors. And Kevin tried to go and learn it without a reduced risk environment, and he got a life-changing head injury. The Crash Reel is the film that they made about Kevin's injury and his recovery and his subsequent work in that space. He now does a lot of great work educating people on traumatic brain injuries. That changed snowboarding a lot, and I think it made people realise just how grave the consequences are at the highest level, when arguably Kevin was at least level with Sean at the time, and all of a sudden he's no longer able to compete at the highest level. So I think, I know sailing's also dangerous and lots of other sports are, but there's an added extra risk involved in high level freestyle snowboarding that sobers you somewhat. From the coaching perspective, I think it's easier to understand this from the coaching perspective. So if you stand at the top of the jump, let's just say it's a slope style jump, and they're going to hit the jump at 45, 50 miles an hour, and they're going to fly 30 meters over the jump, you know, a good 7, 8 meters in the air above the knuckle. All of a sudden, it becomes very obvious that you never, as a coach, want to feel like you are pressuring or coercing or manipulating the athlete into trying to do a brand new trick that they are, you know, this is the first time, even if they've learned, prepped the trick on a reduced risk facility, so airbags or trampolines or foam pits, and it's the first time they're taking it to snow, you don't want to be telling them they have to do that. They need to own that themselves. That has to be their decision. And I think most people can get their head around that quite easily if they picture themselves standing there and the athlete saying to them, should I do it? Should I do it? You're never going to say do it or else. You're going to find a way to support them to make that decision on their own terms. So if you're imagining that same scenario in a group, a crew, that then it becomes really important that they're honest, that they respect one another, that they are generating, if you like, or gathering a shared understanding of where each other's capabilities, edges are. And that's really what happens in those crews of riders. That's why they need it.
I have a question for Luke, but I'm wondering, Derek and Anna, if you're sat with anything.
It's more just an observation, really, that in Leslie's world, it sounds like they operate on the basis of co-opetition, whereas in Luke's world, it's perhaps the other end of the spectrum or the pendulum, where you know it's high stakes competition, but that's not to say that there aren't stakes in co-opetition. I mean, ultimately, from a sociocultural perspective, the sport still needs to draw down on funding from the government to be able to do what they do and put athletes on slopes. but the way in which they go about their business is perhaps a bit more virtuous and a bit more noble. Not to say that there's not that same degree of nobility within sailing, but it strikes me that it's a bit more not cutthroat, but there's certainly a bit more bite around the competitive aspect of the sport. Is that a fair observation or assumption to make, Leslie and Luke and Bradley as well, from a cycling perspective?
Yeah, absolutely, Derek. And they're both, so certainly in the Olympic space, they're all sports. So they have rules and they have criteria, you know, judge sport. And the rules and the criteria shape the way the game is played. So I think the point of sailing, you know, the value of it, the goods of participation are from, I don't know so much about sailing. We've done a little bit of coach development work in sailing, and I love to work in that space. But it seems to me the whole point is to outmaneuver, out-tactic your opponent. That's what makes it special. That's what makes it exciting, as Bradley pointed out. Whereas in freestyle snowboarding, the whole point is to go beyond what's been tried before, you know, tweak that grab a little bit more, spin a little bit differently or further, or go a bit higher. So the reason you're doing it, the thing that makes it valuable, is quite different.
I think cycling kind of sits a bit in the middle here. I'll just share a little story. That 11-month program I'd receive every year back in the early days, those programs that coach held on to, his knowledge, he literally bought on the black market from the Eastern Bloc, because back then, knowledge was power and you held on to it. And that was, this coach became all powerful in Australia, you know, conducting millions of dollars over many, many years. And, you know, it was the be all and end all, was the sole executioner and selector. And now what we're seeing is a shift towards, well, knowledge is the sharing of power. So now you've got national performance directors communicating with each other and giving a little bit and receiving a little bit. It's a complete change. But there's still pockets of the old and there's pockets of the new. So we're in a little bit of a transition, because you've got to recognize in cycling there's an engine build aspect, and then there's tactics and strategies and et cetera. But what I'm getting out of this, and I'll definitely be re-listening back here, is two things. From Luke is that amazing concept where the athlete takes charge and creates their own crew, including in coaching. I think that gets lost for many of our Olympic sports in particular. And Leslie, this concept of, you know, a supportive crew to help you take those risks and take on that progression, what does that look like in other sports? You know, I know in a cycling world, so traditional, to take a risk, even to change a training method with zero physical risk of injury or anything, but to step outside that tradition and into a risky new thing was, you know, in a cultural, in the culture that is cycling was risky. So it's just like that perspective is like, well, hang on a minute, what does that look like in these extreme sports? You know, what are you even considering? There's no risk. It goes back to, you know, when we start to share our stories across different sports and gain that perspective, it's just fascinating, you know, what can be going forward.
I don't think any sport comes without risk, Bradley. Sorry, just to jump in on that one. You know, from a rugby perspective, ethically, we're asking men and women to knock lumps out of each other. And as a coach, you might have strategy or tactics about being really confrontational and physical in the gain line. You're asking an athlete to go out and hurt people and be hurt, and you accept that the sport is, by virtue of its makeup, health harming to both your team and the other team. So, you know, we were talking about risk in extreme sport, but you know, in our sport there are catastrophic injuries as well. I know Anna's doing some work around concussion with World Rugby. So I don't think any sport comes without any risk. I suppose the question is, to what extent are coaches aware of that risk, and are they sensitive to some of the ethical and moral dilemmas that they may find themselves in by virtue of the way that they're designing training and setting up game plans and stuff like that. So that just sparked a little bit for me, Bradley. Thank you.
Yeah, no, cheers, dude. And you know, the deeper question for me is, are we even asking our athletes to be involved in that decision making? I know in Australia here, largely coaching is instructional. You know, it is the coach knowing all and telling the athlete what to do. Are we able to stop and involve athletes in, you know, something similar from sailing? And I'll be definitely leaning on my sailing friends here and seeing what influence that can have across the broader network. You know, where is the athlete in these decisions and ability to take these risks? You know, it's...
But wouldn't you... So I'm not... But isn't the athlete getting out of their bed in the morning going, I want to go to whatever stage they're at, kid just embarking on a sport versus Olympian trying to be champion of planet Earth, you know, isn't them getting out of bed in the morning choosing to go and do it an acceptance perhaps of the risk? Like, so for example, you can, there's, I think there's a study out there that suggests that common phrase where teenagers are reckless, right, and adults are conscious of risk, whatever that risk may be. It's been largely studied. It's not in any way, shape, or form that I say a teenager is not aware of certain risks they're involving themselves in. It's that they value the reward to a higher place than an adult would with experience behind them. And so I think it's wonderfully bliss to have a kid be a kid, whatever kid means, youth person, to blissfully pile drive themselves into something that they love doing. And of course, this isn't in life. There are sadly stories where there was an unfortunate event where something terrible happened. I'm not saying anyone's saying this either. I'm just saying that I think sport should still be open, free, and it should be driven on the inspiration and passion of what you could do, not what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not suggesting everyone said we should be doing the opposite, but I'm a massive believer in the trying to turn things to the positive spin on what could we do, not what might not go wrong. And so I agree, everyone should have the platform to be able to question something and understand if it's right for them. I suppose I'm suggesting that, unless you've got a very pushy parent, if you're getting out of bed and going to the thing that it is you love, for me that's enough. That's the choice of, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, I'm not sure if I articulated that well, but
I'm not sure if it's linked, Luke, but a big challenge we face here in Australia, culture in sport, is when it comes to basic goal setting for our young athletes, who's making those goals? It's largely coaches and parents before the child themselves.
Yeah, okay.
We got some big challenges ahead to.
And what do you mean that there's maybe an essence of kids are being forced and pushed before they've even asked that they have to achieve this next thing, then this next thing, this next.
And for sure, that definitely happens in the UK. It's not that.
Yeah,
100%.
I mean, Laura, you and I could name a bunch of people we grew up with who were wonderfully talented sailors that fell off the cliff because they were probably pushed constantly to do something that was expected of everyone around them but themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And I even made links earlier when you were talking about the kind of individual nature of sailing, like that played out when we were as young as like 14, 15, you know, we didn't want to share. We had separate programs at like 16, 17, and you would be guessing what the other was doing. You know, it was like somewhat ludicrous, but quite exciting.
I loved it.
At the same time, I know you loved it. I remember it well. I can't not ask. As I said in my intro, you've made me thoughtfully smile, as you all have. But look, I'm just conscious that you've arrived on this podcast and used the phrase, you know, a couple of times that you've recently hung up your boots. And you described earlier, I've never heard anybody use this word, but you talked about your career as a sailor and what you were representing. You know, so what was I representing, you know, pre-London, post-London? And I would love to hear from you, having hung up your boots as an Olympic athlete, what are you representing now?
Bloody hell. What am I representing now? I think there's a bark.
Thank you.
Well timed. What am I representing now? Guy, you kind of put me on the spot there. I think the important thing for me at the minute, what I'm representing, is that I don't want to. I'm one of the things I was very conscious of in hanging up my boots. Is I always wanted to hang up my boots when I was still at the top of my game, and that was important to me. I didn't want to be falling off the cliff. I wanted to leave when it was right for me, at the top of my game. And, you know, I've left as top five in the world, still Britain's number one, you know, and I could go on. I suppose what I'm representing now is the, man, Laurie, I don't know. Like, I'm representing a grieving athlete. You know, I think one of the things I've always said to myself is that I'm giving myself the time and space to end this lifelong journey. And for all of us, it's been my entire adult life that I've been chasing this, and pre-adult life. I mean, it really has been a long time. And so I think the word for me is grieving that loss, even though it's a choice, you know. And so I'm representing that, and I suppose I'm keen to represent. I'm not trying to run away from what I've just done. Every day that passes, I look back and I smile. Like, it's very hard when you're in the moment, when you're comparing yourself to maybe multiple gold medalists, to feel inferior, you know, if you're just a singular medalist, you know. And so I'm desperately making sure that I move into a space where I can smile and be proud of everything I've done. So I'm kind of in a bit of purgatory, I think, at the minute. I've got lots of big ambitions and ideas of what next, but I suppose in some respects I'm wanting to lay back and bask in the settledness of having stopped something that's been so heavy on one's heart and one's shoulders for so long, but heavy in a nice way, you know, is a constant drive. And I think as well, watching the Olympics, the next games, I imagine that'll be one of the hardest things, is to watch that and know that I could be there still, but I chose not to, you know. I don't know if that's answered it very well. It's partly because you caught me off guard. I think that's the thing. I'm representing grieving a career, but also smiling at it all at once. And I'm not rushing into anything just yet.
Yeah, well, thanks for wrestling with the question. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate it. And I've been curious in advance of this since we last saw you. And all. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things I find is that, again, similar, I talked earlier about a line in the sand and no one prepares you for it. No one can say anything to you about how you feel when you stop. Like, there isn't a protocol which helps you through that. Of course, our federation is wonderful. You know, Team GB put up support networks, say, call this number if you need, you know, like the mental health side of things, you're supported. But no one is, everyone is different in how they'll feel about it. And I think we all choose to get into sport for different reasons. But what for me, like, crystal clear for me is that it was about being the best in the world and the curiosity of what it would feel like to win an Olympic medal. And I was always acutely aware, and this is a big one for me, I was acutely aware that I was as likely, if not more likely, to fail than succeed. Statistically, you're going to fail. There's only three medals and there's thousands upon thousands of people trying. So statistically, you're definitely not going to achieve what you set out to, but you might. And it was "but you might" that kept me going, you know. And so that's why I bought a lottery ticket about an hour ago, just for a podcast here, you know. And so it was that just kept me going the whole time. And I think I've burnt the candle to be at peace with knowing that my biggest dreams are also in exactly the same arena as my biggest failures. What I would perceive to be a failure. No one else would say that. But my fears might be a better word. Biggest dreams and biggest fears exist in exactly the same space. They're like yin and yang with each other, you know. And that was what I found so addictive. The fear of failure and the what if, but what if, all in one body. It was so much energy, you know.
I'm keen to keep us in the same space, Luke and Bradley and Leslie. I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this. But recently, you know, as we started coming out of COVID, I started working with an apprentice coach who was transitioning from being an Olympic athlete into being a coach. And they talked specifically at the moment in which they knew the gig was up. It was in the middle of lockdown. They were a senior athlete within a program. One of the junior athletes came out of the training facility in tears, essentially expressing their want, their need, their desire to compete. And that was manifesting itself in their emotions. They appeared really distressed. And at that moment, that the coach that I was working with felt nothing. And basically ascribed this moment as being the moment when they knew it was time to step away. And that was months before Tokyo. That's a massive decision to say, I've just not got the fight anymore. Now, Luke, I believe you were talking about your motivations to leave the sport at the top of the game. But when was that recognition event for you and for Bradley and for Leslie to say it's time to step away?
When was the decision to decide to stop?
Yeah. Where did that come from?
For me, the answer is clear for me. The reason was I think I had exhausted all the fuel inside me, which was willing to do all that hard work in the shadows in the background. You know, the desire to win and the curiosity to improve, then execute the perfect race will, I imagine, be with me till I'm old and grey. But we were done. We were on fumes with the stuff in the shadows, the stuff that we all do as athletes that no one sees. You know, that's where, in my opinion, where medals are won. It's not the bit that everyone sees. It's the bit that nobody sees is where it really happens. And like I said, I was on fumes for that bit. And so I had known embarking on Tokyo, so after Rio, that that it was my last games for me. Something dramatic had to change post games to choose to do different. And hey, I tell you, if I woke up and my stomach said let's go again, then that's the answer. That's the fuel back stocked up. But it's not.
It's an interesting question, and I think I'm maybe a little bit unconventional in my exit out of Olympic sport, in that by the time I competed in my last Olympics, I was mostly coaching. I actually had a job as a coach and had competed in a few of the qualification events for the 2010 Olympics and kind of haphazardly qualified. And then I had this amazing opportunity to try and bury some skeletons from the previous Olympics, where I'd unfortunately got really badly hurt about 9 months before the Olympics, and I'd been doing really well in terms of results in the run-up to the 2006 games. And that had ended badly, and had so many negative experiences that I thought, oh, I could get rid of this. And actually I did. I still had an outside chance to perform well as an athlete. But by that time, by 2010, at the end of my career, I was quite broken. I was, 35 years old. That's old for a half-pipe snowboarder. So I was hanging in tatters, just as well I do yoga a lot. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been possible at all. So I'd already decided that I was doing it with a specific purpose. Of course, I was going to try and do my best performance. I was still a top 20 snowboard halfpipe rider. But it was mostly to exorcise some ghosts. Then I think when you realize that the environment that you're performing in or training in doesn't provide the risk level that matches your skills, mental, physical, emotional, to take you into somewhere new and or allow you to learn something, then it's time to change the challenge. So by the time I'd reached the end of my halfpipe career, physically I was too broken to cope with that environment to be able to ride at a high enough level to produce the risk I would have needed to teach me something new. So I was only going to relearn or go over old ground and possibly, even regress as a person and what I was able to learn in that environment. However, there were lots of other environments in snowboarding that did provide a very rich match to my skill level in terms of risk. And just to say something about how I think about risk. So risk comes from the hazard and the exposure to consequences around the hazard create a risk. So risk doesn't exist on its own. There's a hazard there. And as a person doing something, depends what you do around the hazard that will create the risk. That's how you're matching your skills, your capacities, your resources to the available hazard. And I think in this space, I haven't mentioned this already, I'm surprised I haven't. The work on flow state is useful. And the work on biochemistry, on consciousness, on how people innovate, how they create, it for me is there's something in there about risk, tolerance to risk, matching capacities to exposure and hazards that obviously generate the risk, and how that's handled. And as an athlete, I think that we're maybe hearing a bit, Luke picking up on this, you really miss that if you don't have it. So rather than seeking reckless risk taking, to notice that you need that level of challenge if you have been trained your whole life to look for where's the next creative space, where's the next innovation, where's my edge, how can I step over that? You can do that purposely to find that, to create an, or find an environment to create that flow state to be able to learn something new. And for me at the moment, I get a lot out of the backcountry snowboarding and skiing has endless opportunities for finding hazards and managing hazards, identifying, managing, dealing with, performing in, all of those things offer great learning experiences. But you can also find them internally. So yoga offers an internal adventure with its own hazards. I think we've picked up on a few of these as well, and what goes on that you don't see, what's going on that I haven't recognized within myself, and that's all internal. There's endless backcountry to explore internally, which can also offer you lessons and a kind of flow state. So yeah, going a bit metaphysical there, but that's how I see it.
Wow. Holy crap, Leslie, that is amazing.
And we're done. Yeah, and we've ran super over as well. Like, I respect your time. You're starting the day, Brad. So, we need to run to your agenda. So if you want to go for it, go for it. Otherwise, I think Anna's going to take us into
short answer, but it's a tweak now because of what I've just listened to, thanks to Leslie in particular. It's I knew the exact moment I was going to retire. There was a phone call I got from my current team boss at the time. I knew my Olympic cycles were over. I had an average Beijing after three successful cycles, and that was done. I was happy with that. Professionally, I'd worked hard to come back from injury, and my team boss had offered me a continuation of my contract as an athlete. And then late, around about September, so late in the season, he rang me one night and said, "Listen, Brad, just want to say I'll honour this contract we've got, but I'd also want you to consider becoming a team director, which is like a mixture of coaching and management." And as soon as he posed the question, I knew in my heart that was it. That was the moment. I played ball. I said, "Oh, listen, I'll have to consider it and talk to my wife," you know. But I knew in my heart that was the moment. And I've been telling myself ever since that the reason I knew was because a couple of things in it. Retire at your peak or close to it was important, Luke, 100%. And part of that why was I've recognized in other coaches that they had the essence of something that they weren't able to fulfill as an athlete, and they put it into their coaching and supporting others. And I knew I was right on the cusp of that. I had that. If I stop right there and then. But Leslie, what I realize now is what I was attracted to was that scary, risky, holy shit, this could be possible, but who knows, world that I was about to enter into is just sports directing. And I got all of that and some for 5 years. It was amazing. And I knew that was scary, impossible, and complex because in that team, we did a lot of these team building exercises, and I was exposed to leadership roles in those team building exercises in that environment. So I knew I had at least something to offer, but it was scary at the same time. So that risk enter into flow state was absolutely primed for that. So my decision was easy. The reasons around it have just been absolutely opened up thanks to what you've just outlined there, Leslie. And I'll be exploring that further. And what does that look like when I'm supporting other athletes to coaches to coach development, et cetera? What's gonna tickle your fancy, if you like, and get you back into that amazing flow state, which we all love? Thank you.
Hi. We'll have to listen to this many times to pick up all the different great things that have come from this. But yeah, I've been tasked with just finishing off with a little quickfire parting question. So if you can, try and keep it short with your response to this. So based on some of our chats, what recommendations would you make to the sporting system and why? We'll go with Luke first, seeing as we'll just follow the same pattern that we've been going throughout. So go on, Luke, what recommendations would you make?
I think one of the things that I find myself saying a lot, because I believe in it because I got it wrong myself, is one of the recommendations I would make is whatever system it is, whatever sport, make sure the system allows the freedom for the young people to prosper in that in their own individual way. I think a system becomes toxic when it tries to turn itself into a medal factory. And we know the sports because we see them on the media, which ones they are. I'm not going to talk about them, but and I've fallen foul of it, turning myself into one of the lemmings, and I got reaped my worst results. So I would say a system that continues to give that broad spectrum of freedom to young people getting into it and people older in their, you know, more in their careers. Individuality is vital for not only success, but mental well-being and to have a fucking smile on your face at the end of your career.
Love that. Hear, hear. Leslie.
That's a big question. I could spend a whole week unpacking that one, but I won't, promise. I'm just going to say, let more voices in. Listen to more diverse voices. I think the voices in high performance sport are coming from similar places, and I don't think that's healthy.
Yeah.
Maybe a similar thread to Leslie. I think about mentorship. You know, what if we were all mentoring and being mentored? And what if those mentors and mentees were cross sports and cross industry? So that, you know, cross pollination of thought, perspective sharing, and care and support. I think we'd be all going. Our sports systems would be going a lot better if we were able to create that.
Yeah, Derek's just put in the chat, we need a part two.
I think and the part two would be to pull on some threads, specifically a gift that Luke has offered us, and it's very close to research interest of mine around well-being. I'd love to bring Sarah Erdner and Peter Lashonga back on the podcast to discuss well-being in sport, but look at it both from the athlete perspective and the coach perspective, and how athlete well-being is a reflection of coach well-being and vice versa. I think that would be a fantastic conversation to have. So it's perhaps I'm extending an invite right now to you guys in the hope that perhaps we can come back and have a broader discussion with some other people to discuss that.
We'd love to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just on that, Derek, because of the world I come from, where essentially we are trying to choose the people that we think are appropriate to support our goals, is a big, and it's maybe not the right way around to do it, but a big part of, I would definitely feel the pull and the tug to make sure the environment for my coach is right, which I realize is probably an alien concept for an athlete to say that, but that's the world we live in. And it's certainly my personality trait as well. So, it would be an interesting further discussion that I've spent many of my more experienced senior years trying to create an environment where I'm trying to create something that I want them to spring out of bed of in the morning and deal with, and still have time to go home and see their families, despite them trying to facilitate my perfect world. You know, it's a really odd space, I think, sometimes.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, whatever our lived experience tells us around how competitive it is to be an athlete within these performance programs, it's perhaps even more competitive to be a coach in them. And sometimes you never quite know when your next gig's coming around as a coach, and you sometimes jump at the opportunities without necessarily understanding what risks to your own well-being there are by virtue of just jumping in for an opportunity to coach with certain athletes. And there's definitely causality in terms of coaches well-being become diminished as a consequence of the environments that they find themselves in, and not necessarily having the resources or the personal assets to cope with the stressors that exist and they're omnipresent within their environment. So I absolutely love the fact that you are willing enough and transparent enough to have a conversation with any coach in your employ to say, well, actually, this is what, you know, this is what the environment's going to be like, and whether or not that marries up to the resources they have to cope. So I think that's a very forward thinking approach to how you employ your people. So and I don't think that's reflected and replicated elsewhere within the system.
For another time then.
Yeah, Brad, you have to come over and we'll get a dram round the table and extend this by several hours.
Yes,
we'll do that.
Yes,
we'll have a 12-hour session.
Oh, you'll never keep up.
We'll have to do it at 6 in the morning then, so Brad can get smashed in Australia in the evening.
So it'll be, I'll still be drinking whiskey at 6 a.m., I'll tell you.
Absolutely.
It's been a very cathartic process, and I hear a lot of people say that sport is a great vehicle for the development of brilliant people, and with great sincerity I think you three folk are a bloody fine example of that. So thank you for coming on our podcast, and I suspect it's going to take me a while to get to sleep tonight. I thoroughly enjoyed that. Thank you
for having us.
Thank you all. Thanks. Great conversation.
Yeah.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Take care.